Hello, my name is Andrea Calori. I am a program manager at Berkshire Grown. This is Berkshire Grown's podcast series for farmers. In case this is your first time listening, Berkshire Grown is a nonprofit located in the Berkshires in Western Massachusetts with a mission to support and promote local agriculture as a vital part of our region's community, economy, and landscape. This podcast series is an opportunity for farmers to hear from other farmers about what they are doing and how they are doing it. And it's just also a really great way to share stories and continue to learn from each other. As well as with this podcast, it's sometimes not just farmers. Sometimes we do invite folks who are professionals in the agricultural nonprofit world. And today we actually have someone who embodies both of those things. We have Jay Silverman with us. Welcome, Jay.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So Jay, I'm super excited to have you on this podcast. I mean, we've talked already and our conversation was really a lot of fun. But I think the reason why I'm really psyched to have you here is because you are both a farmer as well as someone who works with farmers through your nonprofit work. And I think that's going to be just a really interesting conversation about what it's like to balance on-farm work with off-farm work. So to that effect, do you want to introduce yourself, your farm, and sort of what
sure.
You plan for good?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. No, and I'm looking forward to talking about this too. So so I'm Jay Silverman. I live in Conway, Mass. And my farm is Windrow Farm. So I'm in Conway and I focus on hay production. But I also work for Land for Good, which is a nonprofit based in New England. And so I'm the Massachusetts field agent with Land for Good, and we work on areas of basically working with farmers and landowners on farmland tenure, succession, access, that sort of thing. And also I work at a local beef farm, a Foxbard farm, in their office too, helping to do the office manager piece. So it's a fun sort of way to use all different parts of my brain, from production to helping to planning.
Can you tell a little bit about what you do for your farming?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a hay farmer. I've been sort of a hay nut since I was 2 years old, for reasons that nobody, including myself, can quite put a finger on. So I produce hay. I guess I'm up to about 42 acres right now, which is still pretty darn small scale in the scheme of hay production. You know, I look at other farmers in the area that are doing a couple hundred acres. But then again, I know that I've kind of built it up from, I think my first year I did eight acres, maybe nine, which was nine seasons ago. And I focus on making all small squares, which, you know, I has some capacity limitations. I sell all the hay to local customers. I've got a great, great group of folks doing small scale, food and fiber production, whether it's dairy or meat or fiber. Have some local horse owners, some draft-powered farm folks that get hay from me. So it's a nice kind of well-rounded way to plug it into the food and fiber system.
Yeah, that's one of the things that, like, I really appreciated when I first got in touch with you. And for folks who don't know me, so Jay and I have realized that we have some intersections in terms of our nonprofit work, but I actually was introduced to Jay by contacting him to buy hay for my goats. And was really impressed with Jay's ethos for really focusing on producing high quality hay that is going to end up in our food chain or in our textile supply. Can you just speak a little bit about that philosophy and why that's so important to you?
Yeah, sure. No, thanks. And I really appreciate that. It's, I've always had a really strong environmental and kind of, ethical slant to what I do and what I focus on. I've always been a diehard animal lover and have enjoyed working for other farms with livestock and sort of through studying sustainable ag at UMass, really kind of latched on to the grass farming movement as a means of, ecological restoration of farmland, sequestering carbon, but also really honing in on grass-based animal products, whether that's for food or fiber. And so it's, for a while I had aspirations of having my own beef herd and trying to, do everything, kind of that whole, it ended up really not being feasible for me to try to do that. But then realizing that I've got, you know, my hay is entering the food system through the great people I'm working with. And, you know, it's, I mean, times of trading hay for cheese or, you know, things like that, it just gets really, really tangible in a really cool way.
What, you know, we've talked about it a little bit previously, but what is your, can you talk a little bit about your background into becoming, getting into farming and becoming a farmer? And I think in particular for folks who, younger folks who may be interested in becoming farmers or entering into the agricultural sector, but maybe are first generation farmers, don't have access to land. And then also just your educational background, because I think you, you know, just from talking to you, you certainly utilized your education and college as a way to sort of explore your agricultural interests as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I should say that, you know, first off, I'm a first generation farmer myself. And also I farm entirely on leased land. So those are a couple things I perhaps should have said at the very beginning. So yeah, that's one of my favorite things to talk about. So let's see, I was 2 years old and my folks, neither of which are farmers, although, you know, sort of dragged them into it. And, you know, they bought a house in Conway back in the 80s next to a hayfield. And I came along and somebody gave me a toy tractor for my second birthday. And then I noticed pretty quickly that they were using them next door and something just clicked and I have no idea what it was. And so, you know, I spent my first 10 years or so traveling around town, watching all the hay farmers, sort of memorizing the equipment, playing with toys, toy tractors, and baling my living room floor. And, you know, I always used to joke, I get 4 cuttings a year off the whole house. And so, you know, I grew up working for the farmer that was next door, really kind of became a mentor for me. And, you know, throughout that time, I sort of had this realization, probably in my teenage years, of saying, wait a minute, I don't have a farm to inherit. Like, how is this actually gonna work? And I sort of, it had always been my, you know, hay especially, but hay and farming sort of my biggest passion. It was what I was known for. All my friends knew I was the hay nut. And, you know, I kind of had this existential crisis a little bit saying, like, I don't think this is going to happen. Like, I don't have a farm to farm. And I actually tried to go into computer science for a bit. And then, you know, ended up in environmental science at GCC and then at UMass. And then sort of found my way to the sustainable food and farming program at UMass. This would have been back in like 2010 or so. And at that point in time, it was part of the plant, soil, insect science department. And it since then has moved into the Stockbridge School, which is now has both a 2- and 4-year program. So so through that sort of discovered this idea of grass farming and you know, intertwining environmental stuff that I was so passionate about with grass farming. And, you know, whether that's hay production or just forage in general and pasture health and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it was around 2012 that I had just graduated from UMass. I was still working at the research farm there as well as with the student farm program that I'd gone in, which, you know, really changed my perspective on a lot of stuff. And I just kind of decided to go for it. I bought a tractor. I had some longtime family friends in Conway that wanted to make some pasture available for me to try to raise a couple of beef steers on. And the guy that I grew up working for had, you know, it was insisting on, he insisted on giving me, or he said the first $100 I made, I could buy his old hay tedder. And then he gave it to me and then refused to take any money. And then I think he gave me $100 as a graduation gift. So it was just like a weird, weird way that worked out. But, I basically started at small scale and knocking, and, you know, combination of knocking on people's doors and calling them for fields that I knew that were around that nobody was haying and trying to bring them back. And just sort of slowly over the past, 8 or 9 years have just been challenging myself to kind of up my capacity, you know, up my equipment, start using more barns, you know, in lease or actually even free lease with a lot of them, because it ends up being kind of a win-win with the landowner of having their land managed. It's been sort of interesting having this farm that is an entity, but not really a physicality other than what I do and what equipment I have and what space I occupy. I've had some customers call up and say, oh, I'm going to stop by your farm. And I'd say, well, that kind of depends where I am at the moment.
Yeah. I think it's interesting for those of us who are first generation farmers and don't inherit family land or have even a family farming background, the ways in which we're able to do farming. And it always fascinates me, everyone's story. And I think most of the time when I talk to folks who are in a similar position, we almost always start off small scale, because that's in little chunks at a time. I mean, I was actually, I think it's the first time I heard you say that you've been doing this for 9 seasons now. So that's that's a lot of time to be doing.
Right.
And, but the fact that, you know, you're only doing 42 acres, so you're only producing a certain amount every year. I mean, I know that you are growing, but do you find that even though you are growing in acreage a little bit, that the end goal for you is always to keep it at a small scale?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you said that, because the answer is yes. And part of that is, you know, the economics of it, the reason why I've been able to make my farm a viable part-time income source for myself over the past few years, especially, is that I'm able to keep my overhead really low. And part of that is unfortunately just not scalable as far as the equipment and infrastructure investments I would need in order to try to get the amount of gross income. You know, I'd have to be making so much hay to even just pay off the debt from that, that it would get so big so quickly trying to do that. And that's even assuming I had the capital to make those investments. And then there's the enjoyment factor piece of it too. I mean, I really, as much as I keep doing more hay at a time, I really enjoy interacting with the hay itself and still being able to say, you know, realize the different fields and different nuances, keep certain amounts of, or certain batches of hay separate from one another, really work with customers one-on-one to figure out what they're looking for and what type they're looking for, whether they want more of a fescue-y fine mix or, you know, early season, late season, that kind of thing. And by necessity, you know, a lot of that kind of gets lost when you start getting into bigger scale production with anything. I mean, that's where the commodity mentality starts to take over, because, you know, you just can't chase those kinds of internal logistics as easily. Some people still do, and it's really admirable. Yeah. So, you know, it's the scale at which I enjoy doing it. And, you know, it still feels like a lot when I'm in the thick of it, especially making all small squares and not having any employees and relying on family and friends and equipment behaving correctly. You know, I think that it, in order to continue doing what you love, you have to make sure you keep it at a scale that you still love doing it, if that makes sense. And I know I'd always love it, but I think at a certain point, especially as you start getting disconnected from the physicality of moving hay bales around, you know, it can, at least for me, it might get lost a little bit.
Yeah, that's something I can definitely relate to, because I think, you know, I don't sell anything commercially. I mean, I farm for myself and I produce food for myself and raise animals for myself. But it's interesting, because taking out that the end result of having to earn an income from it or rely on it as being a main source of income, having that out of the equation allows me to enjoy the process of it more and be more engaged with it in a way that I worry I might not be if I were really trying to make it my full-time work. Just talking to you now also makes me think a lot about the different ways we farm, because I think in our last conversation, when you and I spoke, we had talked about how people, when they think about farming and they're going to get into farming and they're looking for land, they have in their mind this image of like the complete farm, and they're gonna purchase or lease like the whole thing, you know, the house, the barn, the land, the infrastructure. And you had mentioned that, you know, farming can come in many different forms. It could be like, as you've mentioned, you know, you have a couple barns here and there that you're leasing where you're storing hay, and you have a couple of different fields here and there that you're haying. Since you're in your nonprofit work, since you're working with a lot of people who are interested in farming and looking to lease land potentially, can you just talk a little bit about that process of how the way we farm is changing and what farming looks like is much more flexible than this, you know, this like complete holistic image of like the whole farm?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I love, you know, working with people on kind of alternative tenure models of land holding, is, you know, it's a fun area to sort of nerd out on. And, yeah, you know, there are certainly folks that are able to acquire kind of that whole farm package through purchasing, where there's a house, right, with some farmland that they're able to get on. Other times it has more, other times it can be more piecemeal. And sort of the strategy that I've employed with my own farming and that I've sort of worked with others at times to have it be a good fit is to have a home base area that you're either able to own or have very secure tenure on through a good lease. And then have additional acreage, additional production area that can be leased, it can be more malleable, allow your business to kind of expand and contract, make use of other infrastructure that's available for use. And, you know, it's rare that people are able to sort of have that whole farm. Well, not about rare, but it really depends on people's scale. And
the availability of land too, or like right. Actual places being available.
Exactly. Well, and infrastructure too. I mean, it's, you look at barns and there's not very many new barns going up these days, but there's a heck of a lot of old ones coming down. And, you know, it's there are people getting innovative with putting up farm tech barns and really trying to make sure that infrastructure piece is still there, you know, even in a rental situation, but it can be really hard to have that investment. And so, you know, for my own farm, the way that I kind of trade that off is I have this low financial overhead, but sort of a higher logistical overhead, if that makes sense. I mean, I'm leapfrogging all the way across town from different hay fields. I try to have different barns kind of near each region, so that way I'm not having to haul things too far and dealing with people buying off the wagon as much as possible. But, you know, my farthest field is like a 42-minute tractor drive from my house. So it's like I leapfrog the whole flying circus across town for one cutting and then bring it back and then go again and then basically play Tetris with all my equipment in the driveway and tarp it for the wintertime. And, you know, that's, I guess, very... It counters as sort of the traditional, you know, owning your farm and I mean, certainly there are times in the season where I dream about having all of my acreage and infrastructure in one place, which is just outside my door. But there's definitely a financial cost to that, which oftentimes doesn't work for either people's scale, or the business model they're going for. Or like you said, just the availability of the land in general, even if you want it, there's no guarantee you'd be able to find it.
So I'm totally going to change our discussion here. I don't know why I just thought of this. I think I was thinking about how you called yourself a hay nut, how you geek out on hay. But, you know, sometimes we do have folks who aren't farmers that listen to this podcast. And I really wanted to bring up a little bit of the nuances in hay, because as someone who feeds hay daily, you know, I have certainly noticed the difference in quality and also the different composition that I'm seeing in terms of the plants. What a difference that makes for the end product, right? Or the end food that someone produces. Can you just talk a little bit about, you know, the sort of the nuances of hay and what you're looking for as a hay farmer and what you know that your customer might be looking for? Because I have to say, like, I've bought like run of the mill, just like, you know, hay from wherever I can get it when I'm in a bind. And now that I have this really rich hay that I bought from you recently. But now my animals are like, won't even touch the other they literally will not touch it. And I was curious. I'm like, I mean, I know that the flavor is probably much more, it's greener. It has like a more dense, it's probably more nutrient dense, I would imagine. But I was even looking at it and looking at the two and just comparing and trying to figure out the different plants that are in there. And what is it that's really separating, you know, the other stuff that I had from last year from the stuff that you had given me? Can you just talk a little bit about sort of the nuances of hay farming?
Sure. Yeah. Boy, I'm hearing all my friends laughing because it's what they can't get me to shut up about. This is great. So first of all, so that way I'm not too oversold, that, you know, the stuff that you got from me this year was, I think, some of the first stuff I made. It was nice and early in the season. I think it was late May. So I don't want to take all the credit.
In fact, I was thinking now when I get more, I'm like, oh my gosh, are they going to snuff at everything
right.
they ever get?
I know. It's so relative. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess sort of I'll try to start with like basics and work my way out from there. So, you know, the two basic types of hay that most people think of and are talking about is first cut versus second cut. So first cut, you have a lot more volume. It's the reproductive stage of the plant. So the grass plants are putting up stalks, they're eventually putting up seed heads. And you know, that's where you're getting, you know, hopefully I hope for like 100 to 110 bales an acre of small squares. And second cut is what regrows after you take first cut off. The plant gives up its reproductive stage at that point and just grows leaves. And so the yield of second cut is less, generally about half, give or take. But the nutritional quality is far greater. And so the example I kind of give, it's a rough one, is saying that first cut is like lettuce and second cut's like spinach. That being said, you know, first cut itself, if you were to graph it, you know, if you start first cut as soon as you possibly can, which is often, you know, to make dry hay anyway, is usually around here late May if you're lucky. You know, yield is usually really low at that point because it's only grown up, you know, maybe a foot and a half or a foot even. And it's a lot more similar to second cut in that at that time period, because while it's still getting ready to do its reproductive stage, it's still mostly leaves. It's trying to capture light. It's trying to get, you know, photosynthesize and get ready for its reproductive stage. So the stuff that you got was sort of that kind of really early first cut, almost second cut, esque feed.
It almost looks like second cut too.
Right. Yeah. It's like second cut with little seed heads in it that are just barely starting to form. And, you know, there's something to be said about that being almost what about more nutritionally dense. It's slightly different. You know, the fact that it does have seed heads, but they're, you know, they're so green and so immature and, you know, not viable seeds by any means. So it's sort of over the course of the season of first cut, and it's being this trade-off where as the grass continues to grow, you know, because I should say, if you're at any kind of scale where, you know, the economics of the equipment you have are very much tied into how much hay you're making, it's rare that you can get first cut done in a short period of time. You know, you're usually looking at least the month of June, you know, these days with weather being so unpredictable, often that drags into July. You know, to eventually get to each field. And you watch the yield go up, but the nutritional content starts to decrease. Really what happens is the grass heads out. And then once those heads start to turn brown and then the grass stalk starts to turn brown, you know, it's essentially losing its sugar and nutrient value in that part of the plant. So when you get a bale of hay of, you know, late season, we call it overripe first cut, the nutritional quality is nowhere near as good. The volume's still there, and it really depends what you're feeding to. You know, sometimes you have horses, so long as they can chew the slightly tougher material. Sometimes that's often better for them because you don't want to feed horses too rich of hay, you know, depending on their needs and whether colic is an issue and, you know, sugar content, that kind of thing. But then the other piece you sort of alluded to also, and something that I really enjoy doing and kind of take pride in, is paying attention to what each field has to offer. And, you know, I'll say every field that I hay, with the exception of one, hasn't been plowed up and reseeded in probably anywhere from 30 to 50 plus years.
Wow.
And so really what's growing there are the grasses that thrive in that microclimate, you know, that particular field, that particular edge of that field. You know, some fields have taken a good amount of work where haying them over a number of years and making kind of weedy mulch. And, you know, the best thing you can really do for grass to make it outcompete weeds is to mow it, as long as you don't overmow it. And so looking at how some fields really have a predominance of fescues and other really fine stemmed grasses that dry down really well and are really good for animals that have trouble chewing or need really kind of, you know, finer material. And then there's others like, you know, I have some fields of timothy that are also up at a higher elevation on the other end of town, and they stay green and don't get overripe, you know, until mid-July. So I can actually do them last and still have the quality be great.
You know, as someone who has worked with beef and who has seen, you know, from field to plate, like the whole gamut there, would you advise someone who was in livestock to really think about where they're sourcing their hay, what's in it, and how it affects the final product?
Yeah, definitely. And a big part of that too is the fertility regimen. You know, making sure that hay is well fertilized. It's sort of I try not to get preachy about it because there's kind of new school, old school philosophies, and they, you know, learn, they both have their merits and have very valuable things to learn from them. But sort of an old school mentality is that fertilizer equals yield. And so, you know, if you're a hay farmer and you want to get as much hay as possible, you need to make sure you put down fertilizer. And that can kind of get into two traps, one of which is then you think if you put down more fertilizer, you'll get more yield. And there's definitely not only diminishing returns, but environmental issues that can arise from that. You know, and the second piece of it too is that if you're not as concerned about yield, that you can falsely think that you just don't need to put down fertilizer. And what really happens is you end up with non-nutritionally dense hay. Because the act of harvesting hay and selling it is essentially exporting nutrients from your land, unless you're putting down manure from the animals that are eating it, or putting down, you know, synthetic fertilizer, which is what I use by necessity, both of financials and just logistics of getting it down on the field. But so really paying attention to the fertility management piece is extremely important to having feed that's nutritional. It's, you know, you are what you eat, and you are what you eat eats, and, you know, that whole cycle.
Yeah, I think it's something that just for the average person who's buying meat, it's not even something you think about, really, right? Like, well, we think about what the animal's eating, but we never even think like down to, well, where is the hay coming from? Right. What's in it, and what like makes that nutrient dense versus not? I find that really fascinating, especially as someone who sort of geeks out over like the nutrition of my animals. I'm always like thinking, what can I give them, or how can I like add and adjust? And because in essence, you know, what I manage my herd holistically with a lot of herbs and no chemicals, which is a challenge, but also it's been this really compelling way of just researching how their bodies work, the mechanism, and how you can just think about what are they eating that's either giving them what they need or creating a deficiency. I mean, it all is tied in together. I mean, even just the land and the soil out here could be deficient in a mineral that a certain animal requires. And so how do you balance things out? It just always feels like in farming, you're always trying to balance things out in some way.
Right. Yep. Trying to balance things out and mimic the kind of natural systems that tend to stabilize when, you know, we're inherently taking a natural system and trying to bend it to our will.
We are. I try to think of it as like, how can we collaborate better? You know, instead of manipulating, how can we really collaborate with it?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I like the word collaborate a lot better. And that's, you know, that's something that really clicks with me with grass farming. It's just that it's this fascinating plant that we ourselves can't immediately eat, but it's so efficient at doing what it does. And it's so good for the land in terms of carbon sequestration and habitat and biodiversity, you know, and being able to utilize that to then feed livestock that we're then getting food products out of ourselves. And I think kind of having that loop is partly why I feel so passionate about having it enter the food system, as you know, food and fiber system wherever possible.
Do you think that there is a demand for more hay in our region?
I love that question. All signs point to yes, in that we, you know, really New England is a net hay importer. We're no matter how much hay we're making here, we're still trucking it in from New York and Pennsylvania and Canada. But packaging is such a huge piece of that. So, you know, we all know the dairy industry is really tragically struggling. And, you know, a lot of them are used to making hay efficiently for their own livestock, either in the form of round bales or wrapped round bales, where you don't have to dry them fully, you wrap it in plastic and it ferments, or making haylage that you actually chop up and put in silos or bunkers to ferment. And so the tonnage of feed is there, but then as sadly dairies either close up or switch to the next generation and they stop dairying, you know, many of them have either been trying to or successfully selling hay, but still in the form of round bales or things that small scale livestock producers can't necessarily make as good use of. So I say all of that because, you know, there have been grumblings about gluts of hay in the region. But when you break that down, it's often gluts of things like round bales and, you know, because for those of you that I'm sure folks have seen round bales, but there's usually a good 12 to 15 square bales worth of hay in one big round bale. And unless you've got a tractor to move it around and a good barn to, you know, store them under cover, as a small scale consumer of hay, you're pretty much with a round bale stuck with getting one in your pickup truck and then being lucky enough to roll it out in the right spot. Whereas, you know, squares, you can handle them by hand. You can put them up in a hayloft. You can, I mean, I've seen people get really creative with places that they store small square bales in garages, above garages, you know, whatever. Right. So to that sense, my experience thus far has been that any good quality small square bales that can be made really get snatched up. And that's where we're stuck, you know, still importing a lot of them at much higher cost from New York, Pennsylvania, and Canada, those kinds of places.
What, sort of transitioning a little bit, what would be advice you would give to a farmer who's interested in producing hay for sale and just getting into it?
Yeah. Boy, you know, I think, I mean, I'm always an advocate for trying something out on a small scale to sort of test the waters, both in terms of your own aptitude, logistics, what the market's like, et cetera. You know, it, being an equipment nerd is definitely helpful. So if, and I say that I'm not a mechanic and I did not come from a mechanical background as far as engines and everything that I've learned about small, or, you know, tractor engine repair has been totally seat of my pants, and also due to some people I'm very fortunate to have in my life that are willing to and eager to share their knowledge. But in terms of just the kind of Rube Goldberg machine stuff, you know, for hang equipment itself, feeling mechanically inclined and willing to kind of study that and figure it out is a really important part of the process. And likewise, especially if you're, you know, haying at a small or even medium scale, used equipment is such an important part of the industry. There's very few of us that can afford to buy a new baler or a new mower or, you know, new much of anything. But the good news is that there's a lot of really still good condition used equipment out there that just need a little bit of TLC and some preventative maintenance and, you know, a little bit of redundancy if you're willing to have a plan B if one breaks down for a little while. I guess my mind keeps going back to logistics, but that's the case for, I think, for just about any kind of farming. You know, the thing I think about hay farming that can be a little bit challenging is that you're so tied to the weather. And while, of course, all farming is reliant upon the weather, you know, with haying, you're looking for usually 3, sometimes if you're lucky, 2-day stretches. Although if you get in the fall, often it's just a 4-day stretch of good sunny weather, no rain. And so you have to be prepared kind of for all these little marathons, sprinting marathons that,
You just had one, didn't you?
Well, this year in particular has been so interesting because it was so dry for so long and now we're finally getting rain, which, you know, had sort of negative impacts on yields. But yeah, it's just, I love planning out logistics to the point where I was having this 8-day stretch where I kept having these days where I was just constantly in motion, just having things planned out, hop from this tractor to that tractor, mow this field, get that one raked, go back over here, ted the second one out, then get the other one baled. And by the end of it, I was just absolutely cooked. which I guess brings me to another good piece of advice is that if you're going to get into hay farming, you better be prepared to ask people for help and to not feel embarrassed doing so. Because it's really hard to do it by yourself.
In all farming, right? Yeah, I mean, I think exactly. All of us, we sort of want to live this ideal where we're completely self-sufficient and independent, right, and we can do it all. And even if you are small scale, I agree, like ask for help if you can. Because there's also a lot of people, I mean, particularly before the pandemic started, but I just remember there was such an interest from the public to want to interact with farms and go on farm and be a part of the process as people are learning more and more about where their food is coming from. And I still think we'll start to see that more coming up again as, you know, our state here in Massachusetts is starting to reopen and people can do things like pick your own, but there might be opportunities to volunteer on farms because you're outside and you can social distance. But I do think there are people out there who want to learn and who want to be a part of the food supply in their state. And the other thing I was thinking about too, even for beginning farmers, and you know, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I would imagine for someone who's interested in learning about hay farming to find someone who's doing it on a small scale and tag along and help out and offer some free labor just to learn the nuts and bolts of it.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, there's no substitute for learning by doing, but learning by doing with someone. You know, it's so easy to be trying to reinvent the wheel when there's such a knowledge base out there. You know, and a lot of the current farmers are getting up there in years, and it's a matter of trying to make sure we glean that knowledge while we can. And honestly, I think that just about any, I don't know, I mean, farmers are always, well, like you said, it's that weird balance of trying to prove you can do it yourself, but also being very welcoming and accepting of help that you can trust. And I think a lot of that is kind of building that trust up, getting to know people. And, but you know, I think some of my fondest memories still are baling days where I've got a big hay party and people there to help. And, you know, there's something about pizza and milkshakes that tastes even better with a group of people after
a hard day of work. Absolutely. Exactly. I know, it always tastes really much better after. We are winding down here, but I have two more questions and topics I just wanted to talk about a little bit. One is, if you could speak a little bit to this balance in your life of on-farm and off-farm work. I think that that's something that many people are starting to embrace, having an off-farm job as well as trying to farm part-time. And it sounds like you've really created a viable way of earning income from two different sources and as a result able to farm. And then once we talk about that, I just want to talk briefly about your marketing strategy because I think it's an excellent one.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, sure. So, you know, it's sort of interesting going from that place in my life where I just thought I would never farm to realizing I would give it a try. And I was always so adamant saying like, nope, this is not just a hobby. Like, no matter what the scale is, it's farming in earnest. It's income that I'm either reinvesting or into the farm or whatever. But particularly in the past few years, you know, things have kind of shifted with my professional life, joining Land for Good, working at Foxbard, and recognizing it at that point in time, the transition to those jobs, that I needed the farm to be at least a part-time income source for me. And that became one of the most rewarding experiences, is rising to that challenge, doing projections, trying to say, okay, you know, what changes do I need to make? Where do I need my production to be in order for this farm, say, to be a quarter of my yearly income? And it's so far been working out quite well. But I, you know, I've also recognized I'm in this really lucky position of having these two jobs that are both very flexible. And, you know, my Land for Good work is mostly work from home, with certainly scheduling meetings and farm visits and that sort of thing on a flexible schedule. And then the farmer workforce is nearby. And then now in the land of COVID-19 has been, that switched to mostly working remotely as well, since I'm managing the office for that farm. So I'm in this really lucky spot of having my non-farming, but still farm-related income be very flexible. And, you know, I'm working with other farmers in the organizations and they're, you know, and when it's time to go hay, that it's understood that can happen. Certainly there's still challenges, like realizing there's workshops and other things coming up and trying not to make everybody's schedule held hostage to my perpetual summer long, can't plan more than 2 days in advance sort of piece of it. And that lends itself to stress. But you know, trying to do any kind of farming, but you know, especially hay being so weather dependent, trying to do that around a non-flexible work schedule is very tough. You know, and I did that for a few years while working at UMass. And even then, they were more flexible than even I should have expected them to be. But, you know, having things be flexible is great. I'd say the downside to it is then, you know, I feel like I now have three jobs that all could, it's hard to turn them off. You know, my brain is constantly thinking about three completely unrelated, but all linked in terms of my livelihood, sets of responsibilities. And so that can lead itself to, you know, tossing and turning at night, that kind of thing. Or when all three separately get stressful, like, you know, I have equipment break, but then all of a sudden Land for Good work picks up and there's a big marketing push at Foxbard. That can get a little crazy, because at least with a single full-time income source, it's all cohesive, and sort of those demands tend, you know, more or less to be at least aware of one another.
It's true. I mean, I can relate, obviously. And I think, but I do think that there is a lot of benefit to having these different different jobs and different work in addition to the farming. I think it gives, there's obviously a level of security, right, in terms yeah. of work. And then also being involved in the agricultural sector in some way, I think just still allows you to be a part of the conversation in addition to having a secure source of income that's not just you and your own business, that's an agribusiness.
Right, right. And they all complement each other so well in that way. I mean, I wouldn't be able to do my land for good work to the way that I can without having that firsthand farming experience and be able to relate to farmers and you know, understand a lot of these challenges about land tenure and farm succession and that sort of thing. And vice versa. I mean, it's helped a lot in terms of my understanding of land use and land tenure from my own farm. So yeah, no, it's very complimentary. And likewise, it feels like I'm using different parts of my brain at any given time. So it's makes me feel well-rounded in that respect too.
Yeah, I would agree. I feel the same way. So lastly, you know, a lot of these podcasts I've been asking farmers to talk a little bit about the effects of COVID-19 on their farming, and mostly the effects that I hear are related to sales strategy and marketing. And that's sort of my forte, I guess, is marketing when it comes to working with farmers on technical assistance and thinking about how to diversify revenue streams, or just thinking about different ways to outreach to the public and get their food product out there. One thing that has come up quite a bit as we're in the middle of this pandemic, and there's, you know, the markets are a little bit different, and the experience at the grocery store is a little bit different. And then the restaurants haven't been as active in the last couple months. So a lot of wholesale accounts have disappeared. And farmers are thinking more and more about that direct sales approach. One thing that has come up is the role of social media and the importance of it in getting the word out there about what you have to offer. And I think it really comes down to this compelling storytelling, just being able to tell your farm story. And one of the things that I remember as a consumer who was looking for hay and was first, word of mouth is gold. I will say this to everyone listening, word of mouth is gold, because I was recommended Jay by someone. But also when I like did the research and I was looking to say, okay, like what's this farm about? I remember looking at your Facebook page and seeing videos of you haying I don't know, there was this quality to it where it felt like I was a part of the experience and I could see visually where the food for my animals would be coming from and that I could be a part of that. And I think it sort of sealed the deal for me in many ways, and having this active presence, like, and still today, you know, just following you on Instagram and on Facebook, I see that, you know, you even talk about when things don't go well and like what's happening and how you're dealing with it. I just, you know, you don't always have to use social media as a way to directly sell a product. You can also use it as a way to just share what you're doing, the good and the mistakes, or like what goes wrong, because even that alone is just establishing a presence and a rapport with a potential customer or with your customer base that is really priceless in my opinion, and I think will eventually turn into sales and to loyal sales in the future.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that. I mean, that's sort of, I guess I approach it from this angle of that I just have this almost pathological obsession with haying and tractors, and like, and I just like to share that with people. And, you know, it's really about sharing a feeling. I mean, I know how much joy it brings me. And I think really all I can wish for other people is that something brings them that much joy as hay brings me. And so trying to share that via, you know, via social media, whether it's just video after video of a first person perspective of baling or whatever, or like you said, saying like, oh, the wagon axle broke today and here's how I'm going to try to fix it. People really seem to connect with that. And it's, you know, started out as friends and family, but then whether it's fellow farmers, whether it's just fellow grass farming enthusiasts or customers, just recognizing there's so many common threads in those stories, and that feels like enthusiasm really kind of carries the day. You know, I'll certainly say too that I'm in a very lucky position right now regarding marketing and COVID, is that, you know, I really have been doing direct sales all along, and it's a different kind of direct sales. You know, it's not like I'm selling CSA shares to people, to a whole bunch of different people. It's, you know, selling decent quantities of hay, to several, you know, livestock owners and farmers, where, I mean, if anything, people were actually more panicky this year that I'm not panicky, but more concerned this year that I'd have the hay for them, rather than me feeling like, oh, this giant wholesale market dried up and now I have to try to get creative. I mean, my heart goes out to farmers, and I'm continually impressed with the farmers in our area, you know, doing sales of food that have been pivoting and coming.
They really have pivoted too. It's pretty incredible what farmers have done out here to meet the demand that people, right, you know, for local food. It's impressive.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Jay, we could keep going, because,
yeah,
you know, the last time we talked, we kept going for like 2 hours. Right. And we did not even get to some of the things I wanted to talk about, but maybe we'll have to do another podcast. It was just really fascinating to hear about, hey, I'm not going to lie.
Well, the music to my ears, because I don't know how many people say that, but I appreciate that anytime.
This is really wonderful. Thank you so much for participating in this. And yeah, I think we've even talked about some potential collaborations for workshops in the future. So for folks who are listening in, be on the lookout for those. We're just thinking about some ways to incorporate some of the work that Jay does into our winter workshops for 2020-2021. So again, Jay, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
And we'll talk soon.